It's Let's Talk Legal with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. Today we have joining us just Cecil Harvell. And with that, Cecil, good morning to you. Thanks for joining
us. Good morning. Good morning, Lockwood. Welcome to Tuesday.
Yes, Tuesday. It's, you know, we're not quite in the middle of the week, but we're getting close. You know,
we're getting close.
A lot of things we've been talking about here recently, and I'm curious. We've talked about estate management and estate planning. And one of the items that's pretty critical, strikes me, in estate matters is powers of attorney. And I know that there are a variety of powers of attorney, but, you know, the whole process, and I think that in many instances, I can imagine that's one of the biggest sticking points in the process for you as an attorney representing a family and estate. You've got to look for that person who has the authority. So how am I correct in the acknowledgement that that is a critical issue?
It is, Lockwood, and let's just kind of begin with the definition. Basically, a power of attorney is a written document whereby what is many times known as the principal appoints an agent to act for them and in their place if they were unable to sign legal documents or legal transfers or to pay their bills, to do things on the behalf of another. Mm-hmm. So it is a written document. There are all sorts of forms, if you will, or different structures of this written document. The important thing is that the document be detailed in the grants of authority, Lockwood, because folks who are going to rely on it, like a bank or a stock company or whoever might be holding a retirement account or the cash value in a life insurance policy, these companies are going to want to see a very specific grant of authority, very specific language in the power of attorney, some sort of generic, well, I let you do anything relative to my banking, is probably not going to make the bank very comfortable.
Right.
So the devil is in the details in terms of the specificity of the authority, the language that is used in the document. So for the sake of our listeners, please be careful just finding these forms off the Internet or at a bookstore somewhere or something like that. You really do need to have some professional consultation with a lawyer, because it's very frustrating, Lockwood, to think that one has a good power of attorney and then later on, you know, the agent, the child, the grandchild, the friend, the neighbor, find out that the power of attorney really isn't very enforceable.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a written document. And we sign these documents, Lockwood, while we, of course, are of sound mind, while we have the capacity to sign them. And then they are just simply held with our other important papers. And then potentially, someday, we might have to activate the power of attorney, and it's activated by recording it in the register of deeds of the county, usually where we are living, where the principal is living, the person who signed the power of attorney. Where do they live? Carter County, Craven County, Onslow County? We record it in that county. Once it's recorded, it is now fully activated, and we're ready to give the power of attorney to the bank, to the insurance company, to the Internal Revenue Service, to the stock company, the broker, and they then will index it into their records, and they now are ready to receive direction from the agent. And the agent now is able to take any action with regard to the assets that we ourselves would be able to do. Now, just like it can be activated, Lockwood, it can be, let's use this word, It can be deactivated.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And how is it deactivated? The legal word probably is revoked. The written document can be revoked by an instrument that revokes it.
Mm-hmm.
I hereby revoke the power of attorney. And then that, too, would need to be recorded so as to put the public on notice that the original power of attorney, which was at one point active, is now not active. Most of the time, the way that the power gets revoked is by executing a new power of attorney, signing a new power of attorney, maybe particularly in favor of another person. Just yesterday, I had some great folks in from Pinal Shores, and their current power of attorney appoints their daughter. Unfortunately, she has now a grave sickness. They're very concerned about her, and they wanted to update their powers of attorney to their son. And so we are changing the power of attorney from the daughter to the son. And, of course, when you change a power of attorney, the appointment in the document, Lockwood, there would be language in the document that says that I hereby revoke all previous powers of attorney signed by me, and that this particular one, now signed in, you know, let's say April of 2022, is the latest and greatest document.
Okay, that was what I was wondering. So you need to specifically identify what I'm wondering, and we'll probably get into this later conversation, if you could have conflicting powers of attorney. So it's very important then to clearly identify that a power of attorney, number one, has been revoked or altered, and we are now power of attorney number two is in force.
Correct.
Okay.
That's right. Uh-huh. Yep.
My question, because I'm thinking there probably have been instances where you've had conflicting powers of attorney. Has that ever happened?
Yes, it has happened. And also, we lawyers even refer to it as, quote, the war of the powers of attorney.
Wow.
where you know, Agent A is in charge. And
right.
Then when next thing you know, a week or two later, it's number B.
Right.
And then a week or two later, after that, it goes back to A. And then a month or two later, it goes to C, you know. And so, you know, yes, that happens, and that's unfortunate when that happens.
Wow.
Something like that, I would be remiss not to bring up, Lockwood, that when you start having, quote, the war of the powers of attorney, that might very likely lead to a guardianship because it's becoming questionable the validity of that of the war of the powers of attorney. I mean, why is the principal appointing this person on 1 month and another person another month and then another person a third month? You know, maybe the principal is under influence. Maybe the principal is not completely comprehending, you know, the importance of this power of attorney. And it might be time, unfortunately, for the court, the clerk of court, to just simply appoint a guardian. The clerk of court, by the way, if there is a good, solid power of attorney on record for an individual, they will use that. They are guided by that in their decision making. It's not binding upon the clerk of court that they name the agent in the power of attorney as the guardian, but it certainly is strong evidence. Obviously, Lockwood, isn't it? That's who the principal at one point in time thought would be the best person to handle their affairs.
Mm-hmm.
And so, therefore, the clerk of court will consider that, and it is what we would refer to as strong evidence, but it's not completely binding. So the power of attorney, again, is this written document. It appoints an agent.
Uh-huh.
It stays in our files until such time as maybe we are needing it. We're at a point where our family member really is unable to handle their affairs, and so it then gets recorded.
Mm-hmm.
And in most files, Lockwood, again, the general rule, you know, is that things just go very, very smoothly. The agent is in charge of their parents' affairs or their uncle or their aunt. They do a good job. They pay their bills. They manage the mail, they sign the tax return, they do anything that has to be done with regard to making sure that the taxes on the home are paid, right. The insurance is continued to be renewed, anything of that nature on behalf of their principal, who is many times their loved one. They're doing this. Yesterday I had a niece actually that was in acting on behalf of her uncle.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked her, I said, I know that you're the niece. Tell me about that. She says, yes. She said, this was my mother's only brother, and he never had children.
Right.
And he asked me to be his agent under his power of attorney, and she's doing a great job. So most of the time things work beautifully, and the agent begins to handle the legal affairs of the principal.
Looking at the situation where you've got a family member, and I want to go back to something you said earlier about the clerk of court. If you've got a situation where you have a close family member, they did not establish a power of attorney, then how do you go about if the clerk of courts establishes an agent for the family, and it might most likely be, in this case, a close member of the family, such as that niece or a nephew? Once that is established, do they have full power of attorney?
Yes, yes. And, of course, again, what you said, Lockwood, for me to put it a little bit into legal language, is that that would happen because of the fact that the person didn't have a sufficient power of attorney or didn't have one at all. If we have a durable power of attorney and it's well drafted and specific of its grant with regard to different authorities, then there's no need for a guardianship because okay. We have the legal authority to handle the affairs of our loved one. But if someone never got a power of attorney or has a power of attorney that's out of date or has a power of attorney that's defective in some way because it's too general in nature, then at that point, the family has no choice but to go and get what let's call it this, a legal, a court-appointed power uh-huh. of attorney. And a court-appointed power of attorney is a guardian.
Okay. Now, you just used a statement that caught my attention. Out of date?
Out of date because of the fact that it would not have the specific grants of authority. Okay. It just doesn't have the specificity that
Understood.
A bank or a stock company Ooh. Or register of deeds wants to see. That would be kind of what I'm referring to as out of date.
Okay. And then the other question I have, and this goes back to questions I've asked in the past. Powers of attorney, are they different from state to state? Because
they are.
Oh, okay.
That's
a big issue because, again, we talked about this a couple of weeks back. The fact that people are moving into the state from other states, carrying with them their documents and making the assumption, well, I've got my will, I've got my power of attorney, I'm settled, I don't have to worry. Okay, now we're sitting in Cecil Harvell's office there at Harvell and Collins.
Right.
Should I worry, Cecil?
Yeah. No. A power of attorney is a document that would be that will change the terminology, the language would change from state to state. Now let's talk about something you keep mentioning, Lockwood. There are different types of powers of attorney.
Mm-hmm.
One of the types is that's the most common is the durable power of attorney, which means that it continues to be active during the quote duration of an incapacity. So all throughout the incapacity of the principal, all throughout their inability to handle their affairs, the durable power of attorney is in force and is activated. A durable power of attorney, not only is it for the duration of the incapacity, but it also is no longer in effect once someone dies. The executor takes over, and the agent of the power of attorney doesn't have any power anymore under the durable power of attorney because the principal is no longer living. There is also, and it would be general in nature, this durable power of attorney. When I say general, I mean real property, taxes, insurance, bill paying, stock accounts, really any tax returns, really anything, settling lawsuits, anything and everything having to do with our financial life. There is also, however, sometimes what might be called the soldier's power of attorney. That's kind of interesting. I'm glad I thought to bring that up. The soldier's power of attorney, or a special power of attorney. This is a power of attorney that is very specific. Someone is leaving the country. They are not going to be available for a specific period of time. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it kind of maybe has a start date and an ending date. It also might be limited to a particular kind of action, like the authority to sell real estate, mm-hmm, or to buy real estate. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have the authority for banking or for stocks or for retirement accounts. It's limited in its nature only to the authority to handle a real estate transaction. Uh-huh. So that would be what would be known as a special power of attorney, which is many times what our armed forces men and women have,
right,
when they leave the country. They will give to their spouse a power of attorney for the duration of deployment.
Right.
Yeah. During the duration of their deployment, their spouse needs the authority to handle things, and so during that time, they have the power of attorney. When they return from their deployment, then the power of attorney is no longer valid because it was limited in its nature. So there is, as you say, Lockwood, these different types of powers of attorney. I will say that by and large, 99% of the time, it is just simply a general durable power of attorney, because that one serves all purposes under whatever the circumstances might be. For instance, even during a deployment, if a wonderful soldier has a power of attorney that's durable, even though it's not limited, it would certainly work, mm-hmm, if you know what I'm saying.
Right, right. The other aspect, and related to that special power of attorney, I would assume that that's also used in some instances in just purely business transactions. For example, you identify an agent to represent you in a business transaction. You can't be present to do the signature responsibilities, things of this nature. So I'm wondering, is that used, and we're going away from estates but into business, but is that used also in a kind of a business environment as well?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I have a question on the durable power of attorney here, and it's related to I'm intrigued that the fact that the durable power of attorney basically comes to conclusion upon the death of the principal, in that which case the executor steps in. In the case of a durable power of attorney, you have some people that actually act as the agents for individuals, loved ones, mothers, fathers, things of this nature, that officially don't have a power of attorney, yet they're filling out the checks. Maybe their name is also on the check signing card, things of this nature. If you don't have a durable power of attorney, if you aren't specifically identified, is there a possibility of liability challenges?
Yes, yes.
Ooh.
Yes. I mean, what you're mentioning is that there are certainly other ways in which someone might have the agency or power,
right,
to handle an asset. Like, for instance, at the bank, if you are a joint owner on the account, and that can be the son or daughter or granddaughter,
right,
then you have the right to sign checks on that account because you are the joint owner. Maybe also you have been added to a stock account,
uh-huh,
as a joint owner. Well, because you have this joint ownership, you therefore are allowed access to the account.
Uh-huh.
But but that can cause, that's a dangerous substitute, if you will, Lockwood.
Okay, that's right. I'm wondering. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, because we don't need necessarily our loved one to be the co-owner on our account. We just need them to have access to the account through a power of attorney. If they're the co-owner on an account, then they are the co-owner. And with ownership comes liability, comes creditors, comes bankruptcies, divorces. All of those kinds of twists and turns of life are going to attach to the co-ownership of the account. So, for instance, we add our son or daughter to our $100,000, you know, stock account or bank account or CD. All right, now all of a sudden, unfortunately, our son or daughter goes through a divorce, and the attorney adverse to the child says, well, but you own that CD, don't you? It's part of your ownership of assets. Or a creditor says that, or it's included in a bankruptcy. So we get this question all the time, shouldn't I just add my son or daughter, grandson, granddaughter to my account? And the answer really is no, we don't want you to do that. We don't mind you doing that on something on a limited basis, a very, you know, $20,000 account or something like that. But don't go add your child to all of your accounts, because the bottom line is that then that account could be subject to the twists and turns of the child's life. The way in to handle that is to have the child or the agent to be the power of attorney over the account. That's very different.
Is that okay? Reason I'm asking that question, Cecil, is that it, in essence, the power of attorney, of course, we always think of the power of the attorney being to the benefit of the principal, in this case, the person identified to be cared for. But at the same time, in the opposite direction, if you will, the power of attorney protects the individual that will be offering those services, because if they are, as you just pointed out, co-owners, co-signers on the documents, then suddenly they are also share in the liability. I think that a lot of folks think of powers of attorney as just, if you will, the beneficiary to the principal. But you're sharing with us that it's also a benefit, if you really get right down to it, to the individual identified to be the, I'll use the word executor, but the person managing that particular activity. That's something that I had never considered before.
Well, that's important, and we are very concerned when we find that clients have necessarily added a child to their account, and their account is significant, and then we ask the question, well, you know, Miss Sally, why do you have your daughter on your account? You know, and the answer is almost always, well, I want her to be able to sign, pay my bills. If I were unable to do so, I want her to have access to my account. And then, of course, that's when I then say, well, you know, Miss Sue, she will have access since she has a durable power of attorney. She will have complete and total access to all of your accounts if we have a power of attorney. There's a difference between her having access by and through a durable power of attorney and her having access as an owner on the account.
We're talking with Cecil Harvell of Harvell & Collins about the issues of powers of attorney. And, Cecil, I want to go to one final aspect of this because this is something that gets brought up in conversations related to powers of attorney, and that is living wills. And, for example, the decision, and I can speak to this personally, the decision of being and having the privilege or right or, if you will, the challenge of having to make that ultimate decision for a loved one. Is there, you know, what is the process of that? And does that qualify as a kind of a power of attorney?
Well, any kind of health care decision, and I'm glad you brought that up, but I know we're going to be a little short on time.
We're okay on time.
This could be Lockwood, what we talk about next week, the interplay between a health care power of attorney, a HIPAA release, and a living will, or declaration of desire for natural death. But again, quickly, Lockwood, any health care issue, any decision with regard to our health, is going to be dictated by the health care power of attorney, not the durable power of attorney. They're separate and distinct documents. In the state of North Carolina, our legislature absolutely has promulgated a very wonderful health care proxy or health care power of attorney, and that's what most lawyers are going to use for their clients, and it's going to parallel, if you will, or track the North Carolina general statute. It then is going to give the health care agent the power to make health care decisions, including the authority to bring forth, if you will, the declaration of desire for natural death. That is not so much the decision of the agent under a health care power of attorney. That is our own personal declaration that we have made in a document, in writing, that should we be terminal incurable, should we be in a persistent vegetative state, then we authorize the physician to allow us to have a natural demise without the interference of extraordinary measures like artificial nutrition, hydration, things of that nature. That, my friend Lockwood, is a signed declaration that the principal makes, that should I be under these extreme circumstances, I myself hereby state and declare, for the benefit of my family and my physicians and my health care institutions, that I do not want my life to be prolonged. Now, that is a that is not the decision of the agent. That is the that's the decision of the principal, signed and notarized and witnessed appropriately. And all the agent under the health care document would do is simply know that it exists in the important papers of their loved one, and, if you will, bring it forth to the medical institution and to the attention of the doctors. But it isn't a decision of the agent. That is the decision that the principal made.
All right. I'm looking forward to next week's conversation because I think that's where we'll be headed. And, you know, it's interesting, Cecil, as we wrap it up with you, you just referenced one other aspect of this that's kind of a cloudy area, and that's where do we keep those important documents? Because in the situation as we just described a moment ago, it could happen very quickly, and having access to those documents are pretty important. So I look forward to that conversation as well. Cecil Harvell with Harvell and Collins with us this morning. And again, that number, 252 area code 726-9050, that's 726-9050, or go online to harvellandcollins.com and spell out the word and, please, harvellandcollins.com. As always, Cecil, a pleasure talking with you. Look forward to next week.
Thank you, Lockwood.